Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen. Each month, I'm joined by a member of our investment team or a guest from one of the investors in our universe to talk about the investment themes and opportunities that are available today to family investors. What is CapGen? We're a private investment office for families with capital. Our clients are sophisticated, internationally minded investors, and what we do is to help them make the most of their capital and to seek out investment opportunities across any asset class in any region of the world. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover a globally diversified portfolio of assets and sectors, be that bricks and mortar or derivatives. In summary then, this is a podcast where we discuss the questions that we think are playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. If that sounds up your street, do please subscribe and you'll enjoy a new episode published on the first Thursday of each month. Welcome to Talking Capital. Today's episode is the third on the theme of private equity, and I'm speaking today to Mike Ascione of US-based private equity manager Berkshire Partners. Mike is a managing director in Berkshire's Boston office and specializes in industrials and business and consumer services. He has a background in corporate finance. Mike, welcome, and it's great to have you here.
Ian, thank you very much for having me, and very excited to be part of your podcast.
So for those of us who don't know, not familiar with Berkshire, there may be one or two out there. Could you give us the backstory, Mike? So where does Berkshire come from? What's its origin story?
Sure thing, Ian. So Berkshire Partners was founded at this point nearly 40 years ago. We had five individuals who were the founders of the firm, and from day one, set out to create a true partnership model within their private equity investment firm. We've obviously grown pretty significantly over the last 40 years, but we've stayed true to our roots in terms of being a mostly North American-based, middle market-focused, growth-oriented buyout investor. We've obviously scaled over time in terms of our capabilities and the resources that we bring to the middle market. But our focus in terms of helping to grow and develop and institutionalize high quality middle market businesses has remained pretty true over that last 40 years. So we've been very fortunate. Coming from a great foundation, a wonderful team, a team that emphasized culture and teamwork and relationship development over a long period of time, we've managed to produce some pretty good success over those four decades.
So four decades, a long time, particularly in investment management, and to stay pretty true to where you started. And I'm sure almost everything went swimmingly, Mike, but we learn from our mistakes, I guess. So maybe one or two along the way. How do you have learning experiences at Berkshire? So on the rare occasion when something doesn't go swimmingly, how do you identify it and how do you remedy?
Yeah, it's a great question, Ian. And I always like to say, from the outside, it appears that things have just gone up and to the right? But the reality is along the way, there's a lot of volatility. Rarely do things go completely as planned or hoped for. We have always taken a long-term orientation to what we do, how we make decisions, how we think about investing in our companies, how we think about investing in our capabilities, how we resource our investments, because again, we're playing for that long term up to the right, despite the fact that in between things can happen, and things certainly have. Nobody is perfect, especially over a 40-year time period. I think we've been fortunate. And I'll go back to maybe the core values of the firm. Right, it's a team oriented, truth-seeking, fact-based environment. We believe that the power of the team over long periods of time should produce good consistency. The other thing that it produces is good trust, right? And that trust is important amongst ourselves when things don't go right. right? When we make a bad investment decision, which we have thankfully there haven't been that many of them, but we're certainly not immune to that. And part of it starts with understanding what happened, being very sort of fact and truth based around it, learning from that, diagnosing and learning, and having the trust in each other and our partners to think about how do we remedy that going forward? How do we need to continue to evolve as a firm, where we need to improve as our market has changed, as the private equity landscape has changed. We've always been, I think, very self-reflective in it. It really starts there.
And, we talk about mistakes because, it's jeopardy that's interesting and stimulating. So forgive me for staying on that. I'm curious, Mike, when I talk to people and look at firms about how they see error, and I think, there's a spectrum from seeing error as an individual doing something or error as a group. It might be expressed through an individual, but actually it's a group. Where's Berkshire's bias in this? Do you see errors as individuals or do you see errors as coming from groups?
I think it can be a little bit of both. I think we have to be honest with the source of a mistake. I'll caveat all this, Ian, with, again, kind of going back, we've been fortunate to not have that many mistakes. Over the course of 11 funds, our worst performing fund has, I think, we've never had a fund lower than 2.2 times net MOI, right? So we have been fortunate on that aspect. We do believe that we make decisions as a team. Now, as an individual and as a deal lead, I can tell you, I feel enormous personal responsibility for decisions that I help lead. And when a mistake is made, I think everybody in this firm feels enormous responsibility. But we also understand that mistakes are going to be made over time. And that's when the team needs to support and help how we remedy those situations. We've had situations in the past where we just got the diligence wrong because we didn't understand well enough what we were underwriting. I was listening to your last podcast and I was struck by, I think, a comment made that as you reflect on your business, that you can't go into a market fresh, that you have to have relationships and sort of be in the flow to be able to understand what to underwrite and how. 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we could basically be generalists, and you had the time and the luxury to go into something fresh and be able to learn it on the fly. That doesn't exist today. We have to be specialists and sector experts within the four sectors that we cover. We are a multi-sector firm in the middle market. We go to market against those four sectors, and you can't be fresh. You have to understand what you want to own and why. And that has helped us reduce that margin of error over time. There are other times where the quote unquote mistake comes from your thesis is correct, but you just, the circumstances changed over there, the environment changed, and it has put a particular investment into a tighter spot. So we work to try and assess those and have different approaches. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, though, it's a balance of both. It's being honest when an individual makes mistake, but also making sure that we're supporting as a team to drive to where we need to drive to as an organization.
And looking at the other side of that, Mike, so looking at success, so you've clearly had a lot of success and you've clearly had more success than not success, because otherwise we probably wouldn't be talking to one another. But when you think about success in the firm, what does celebration look like? Is it a sort of quiet celebration? Is it a noisy celebration? How do you culturally think about success and what you want to acknowledge and praise? Is it the process? Is it the outcome? I think it's very interesting the way I see success celebrated in lots of different ways. There are people who are quite embarrassed by it. There are others who want to talk about it, and this is not to judge your team. I think it's just a different thing. I'm just curious as where you find yourselves there.
Yeah, we tend to be on the more modest side of celebrating success. We have generally kept a lower profile. We have liked being a little bit below the radar. We let our investment results speak for themselves. we absolutely celebrate success internally in a number of ways. I don't think we go about it in a real chest beating sort of way. We certainly acknowledge and celebrate those wins, because I think that's important to do. You know, it's interesting, Ian, we're also hard on ourselves, perhaps maybe sometimes too much so. One of the jokes internally is, one of the things I like to say, when we never celebrate a new investment. I always say the new investment is the easy part. We'll celebrate when we make money on this new investment. So that has become a mantra internally, you know, across the firm. But even when we have big wins, you know, we had a massive win last year with the sale of our roofing distribution business, SRS, to Home Depot for $18 billion. There was a lot of congratulations, but again, it's fairly modest. Like we just, for better or for worse, we're kind of on to the next thing. And we think that's important to kind of keep an even keel, you know, throughout both the highs and the lows.
I was smiling because what you say about the celebration coming at the end rather than the beginning echoes something that Khaled Said, our managing partner, often talks about as we sit together in the investment committee. And clearly, if you're part of the research team, it's a sign of success and approbation to have something that you put forward added to our list of managers. But Khaled often reminds us that as a wealth owner, the excitement comes at the end, not the beginning. And yeah, that's very interesting you say that. I do want to come on to investment philosophy, although I think we've seen a glimpse of the culture that lies behind it. But I just want to stick on one thing about Berkshire. We've had a little look back at where you are now, a bit of a look forward. So, you know, you've seen a lot of evolution. You've been doing it for a long time. 40 years is a long time, and to keep doing the same thing. What lies ahead? And I suppose I'm intrigued by the question of what the future of private equity looks like. And I suppose, you know, if one was to sort of juxtapose it, there's a choice, isn't there, between an ownership model where you have one person, one group in control, and the alternative model that's out there is you have dispersed control, but those people have liquidity. And there's something about what it feels like to be an investor, but I suppose there's something that also about what it feels like to be a company and which ownership model looks better. What are your reflections on now also, I guess, and the background that you've described is that not only you, Berkshire, but the industry as a whole has become much more meaningful. What are your reflections on the future of private equity buyouts as an ownership model?
You know, there's no doubt that over the last 30 plus years, the private equity asset class has institutionalized and I think has become a really important part of the capital markets landscape. You know, it was a niche-y ownership strategy 30 years ago. It's no longer niche-y. It's very prevalent. It's become, as the public markets in many ways have become much more difficult, I think, for smaller size companies to be a participant in, private equity has helped fill that role. So it's helped provide liquidity to entrepreneurs and founders and families over time. You know, I think as an ownership model, particularly for a middle market business, I think it is one of the best ownership models you can have. You know, we spend a lot of time with our businesses talking about, we're not managing quarter to quarter. Yes, we want to see earnings, we want to see growth over periods of time, but we can make investments and strategic investments and invest in our resources because, again, we're ultimately trying to move from up and to the right over a long sweep of time. We can be very focused on our discussions of what's important, not necessarily about, you know, risk management that you begin to get into within the public market. So I think it's a very important form of ownership. I think it's a very compelling and effective form of ownership when done well. And I think it's going to continue to play a pretty important role in our capital markets, in the global capital markets over time. That said, like any industry, it's become more competitive over time as it's institutionalized. So I think it's important that firms, and particularly firms in the middle market, are doing things well. You're becoming sector and subsector experts, so you really understand, again, what it is you're underwriting. You've invested in the resources to be able to drive true value creation, to help institutionalize businesses. I mean, we've made a massive investment in our portfolio support and our resources. We believe strongly that in the mid-market, if you can bring that, it can be a real differentiating factor. We have been the beneficiary of a very good brand and reputation as being a partner, which is important in our market as well. So you put all those things together with a longer term orientation and our ability to sit with a business and say, listen, this is a company that can be a long-term compounder, and we want to invest and help make you successful and be part of this chapter, help bring the resources and be a good partner to get you there. And I think that's going to continue to be important, but it is absolutely a competitive business, strong reputation, great track record, and investing in resources is really key to success going forward.
Just zooming out a little bit further, Mike. So is the growth of private equity because we've discovered a better ownership model, or is it because the alternative ownership model has just got worse, viz. The public markets, and private equity has stepped into a gap created? So, you know, born to greatness or greatness thrust upon it. How do you reflect on that?
That's a very good question, Ian. I think it may be a little bit of both. I think it is a focused ownership-driven model is a very effective ownership model. So I think it starts there. I think the public markets can be a wonderful ownership model for a company at the right stage, scale, and size. And companies do grow to a point where they need that access to capital that comes with the public market. So am I indicating that public markets aren't a good form of ownership? I think they just have to, today it has to be for the right type of company at the right stage and right scale. And that's where I think the private equity ownership spans both of those.
Mike, thank you. Stepping forward to the next topic, having, I guess, set the scene, talked a bit about Berkshire, its background and culture and how you see the industry you're in. Can we talk a bit about investment style and philosophy? So what is the Berkshire way? What is it? How do you start thinking about there? Your limited partners have made these commitments to you. You've got this, as you describe, burden of responsibility. What are you going to do with that money? How do you start thinking about what you're going to do and direction in which you point, the directions in which you choose not to point? You then see lots of things, as we all do. How do you find the one or the ones that are better than the rest?
Yeah.
And what does better look like in your eyes, I guess?
Yeah.
Because better's not objective, is it? It's objective when you sell it, but it's subjective when you start.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you step back and just for the audience, you know, our funnel, we probably see about close to 1,000 opportunities a year in an average year. That'll move a little bit one way or the other depending on the market, but 1,000 overall opportunities, and at the end of a given year, we've made somewhere between probably 4 and 7 investments, right? So it's a wide funnel up at top, very narrow at the bottom. It starts with our 4 sector teams. So we've got business and consumer services, industrials, healthcare, and tech and comms. Those are our 4 teams. And each of those 4 teams have a handful, somewhere probably between 3 and 5 subsectors that they are really focused on, understanding themes, secular trends.
Are those static or do those change over time, Mike?
You'll see them change over time. They're not going to change year to year, but they're constantly evaluated. So we have an annual planning process that each team goes through, updating their subsectors, where we are, what the opportunity set is, what themes they're pursuing. There'll be some things that come on over time, and some things that may fall off because the investment set, for whatever reason, perhaps proves to be less attractive than what we thought. So that, you know, that it starts with that. The investment opportunities have to be within those core sectors. And as our teams identify the most attractive companies in those sectors, they're working hard to really get ahead and understand those businesses, the decision makers. Kind of goes back to, again, you have to really have conviction in the risk that you're underwriting. And the more you've done well in advance to understand that, the better off you're going to be. We call it our top targeting process. If you look at our last 25 investments, Ian, probably 23 of them have come off of our what we call our top target list. And on average, it's been a couple years worth of relationship development and work to get in front of those and to get in front of those opportunities. So that's from a kind of from a business development perspective. In terms of what we look for, so in those sectors where we've developed some conviction around themes and theses, you know, we're a growth biased firm. So almost anything we underwrite is not going to be just market GDP type growth. It'll have relatively strong organic growth opportunity set that might be driven by secular tailwinds. It might be driven by companies that are really gaining market share, winning in their markets. It may be driven by an M&A component, usually is enhanced by the M&A component as opposed to truly driven. So that growth orientation is very important. And we believe these businesses that we invest in have the opportunity to grow into kind of long-term compounders and market leaders. Some of them are market leaders up front, and some of them we believe have a path to market leadership. And we're really trying to bring our resources as a firm to help inflect that growth and get them to that market leadership element. You know, market leaders exhibit good economic models. They operate in sound industries where you can kind of understand the profit pool of the industry. Those are the characteristics that, you know, that we're looking for. I'd also say that a good portion of our deals, our investments, are situations where there's a partner on the other side who cares very much about who their next partner is. It could be a founder, it could be a management team, it could be a family. And Berkshire has done a good job over a period of time in that top target process of positioning ourselves as the partner of choice, because of our knowledge, because of who we are, because of brand, reputation, and, you know, history of success. So those are the elements that we're looking for as we're really digging into those situations.
On the other side, so that you described, the partner that you want to work with, who themselves are very discriminating about who it is they wish to partner with, what does that look and feel like? I mean, is it different in every instance, or is there something that people see that is particularly you? There's that Berkshire thing that they feel. How would you describe it?
In many ways, it comes back to our core values, right? Which are, it's relationships matter, it's winning the right way, and it's the power of teams. Those elements tend to resonate with our management partners, with our investor partners, because we don't come in saying, We know all the answers. We come in saying, you've built a great business, and we have a good history of being thoughtful partners. And our approach is about consensus. It's about collaboration. It's about getting to the truth. And it's almost the same way that we run ourselves internally, I think, resonates with a lot of our management partners, where lots of expertise, but it's a discussion. It's a dialogue. We're aligning on the key strategic priorities for the business. That's always critical. And there's a lot of work that goes into that. But ultimately, we're also very upfront that it's not our job to run a business. It's the management team's job to run that business. We're going to hold them accountable. But we're not operators. We're investors, and we're here to bring our resources and our wide area of support to help them ultimately be successful. And I think those components resonate. You have a wide degree of operating models within the private equity universe. And by the way, I always say there's lots of models that work. This happens to be our model. And what's important to do is to align your investment strategy, your target, the targets that you're going after with your operating model to hopefully achieve the most success that you can.
Can we inject price into this, Mike? And can you talk a bit about, so I'm a management team, or I'm the current shareholder, and I'm looking at you, and how am I thinking about the relationship between price and relationship?
Yeah, well, we work hard to convince all of our those decision makers that they should take a lower price because we're going to be a better relationship and drive better value on the back end. We work very hard to convince the decision makers of that. Sometimes it works, but I also it's a very efficient market. So while we work hard to get ahead of opportunities, we're oftentimes able to unlock opportunities outside of a process. We're oftentimes able to preempt a process. The market is pretty efficient and sellers are sophisticated and they understand what the value of their business is. So, you know, I always like to say you don't get it in today's world. It's hard to get things at a bargain. What you hopefully have done is put yourself in position where your conviction level is higher than others because you've been able to do more work, been able to gain more insight, and therefore you're able to underwrite more growth going forward that allows you to pay the price that's needed. And that's really what we're trying to unlock. We'd like to buy everything at a discount, but in today's world, it's a hard thing to achieve.
Thank you, Mike. Moving to the third topic. So we started this cycle in the first of these three monthly episodes with Robert talking broadly about private equity and the middle market and the US and the opportunities there. We then had Enrica describing her search. And Mike, you've helpfully talked about the way you do things and the way you think. But to bring it all to a point of the spear, it'd be really helpful if you could illustrate what you've been talking about by describing a particular transaction investment that you've made, whether it's one that's been completed and gone, one that's, you know, live. It just, I think, be very helpful for all of us to see how what you describe translates into action. And I suppose for those listeners who are or will be limited partners in your funds to see, okay, so where is my money going? What are they doing with it?
Yeah. Well, happy to. And you know, I'll come back again. I think in your last podcast, spending a bunch of time as to why you find the middle market to be an attractive place to search for managers. And we find the middle market to be an attractive place to invest in because we feel like you can find businesses and investment opportunities that are in an interesting stage of their life cycle and be able to work to help inflect and grow those businesses. And we've been fortunate to have had some great successes over the years. As an example, SRS Distribution is an easy one to talk about. SRS is a business that we first invested in 2013. It's a roofing distribution business. So SRS's business model in 2013 was, to be honest, super easy. They distributed roofing shingle to the job site for roofing contractors. A business that from the outside, in terms of industry, looked sort of, you know, pretty generic. But as you dug into the company, there were some interesting things. First off, we were searching for something in roofing distribution because we had a thesis back then that roofing was more of a repair and replace than tied to new build.
So there's a bit of a macro thing there, which is you wanted to avoid an exposure to initial home starts.
Correct. We had historically made some investments that were in the housing and construction sector that had been very successful for us as we thought about what was next. Roofing distribution was one of the areas, kind of sub-verticals that we had targeted. We had begun to meet with various players and ultimately found ourselves introduced to Ron Ross and Dan Tinker, who had founded SRS and had a ton of experience. Back then, SRS was a $40, $45 million EBITDA business, had some really unique attributes. It was growing double-digit organically. It was consistently taking share in a very, very fragmented market. It had begun to build an M&A engine. And a very compelling M&A engine. So it had this high growth model within, again, from the outside, you'd say was an industry that was kind of a normal industry. And the culture of SRS was unique and special, and their ability to translate that culture into execution and ability to outcompete, again, in a very fragmented market was astonishing. So we were fortunate. We partnered with SRS back then. We invested, I think, $275, $300 million at the time. And about 5-6 years later, SRS had grown from 40 something to the mid 200s of EBITDA, and it had been a very good mix of organic growth and M&A. And along the way, we had spent a lot of time with the company on helping them continue to build out that M&A function, continuing to help them build out how they thought about integration capabilities, help from an organizational scalability perspective. There was some succession along the way, and really working on how do you continue to scale this business so it can continue to grow. And again, we were very fortunate that we had amazing partners in Ron and Dan. So it was, you know, 5-6 years in, it was a very successful story. I'd also remark, Ian, SRS was also interesting in that it had a very wide and deep employee ownership model. They had driven employee ownership throughout the entire organization. We decided, along with management, that we were going to seek liquidity. In that process, we had a new partner come in to recapitalize the business. We ended up rolling a significant amount of money into that transaction. And again, it was a phenomenal outcome for us at that period of time. And, you know, that was about 5 years ago. And over the course of this last 5 years, SRS has grown from the mid 200s to over $1 billion of EBITDA. Truly, truly remarkable. And during that time, they moved into new adjacent markets, landscaping supply, pool supply. And what they were able to prove was that their execution capability around distribution enabled them to move into adjacent markets. In early first half of last year, that business, SRS, was sold to Home Depot for nearly $18 billion. And a remarkable outcome. Company had, I think, close to 11,000 employees at the time of the sale. About 10,000 of those employees were shareholders in the business. Incredible wealth creation throughout every level of SRS. So it gives you an example. Obviously, that SRS is sort of in the pantheon of amazing investments for not only us, but within the private equity industry. But it just remarkable of sort of a mid-market company that just kept finding ways to grow and out-execute. And we owe a immense amount of gratitude to Dan Tinker, Ron Ross, and the SRS team, who were just incredible partners along the way.
So this is a super unfair question, Mike, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So in that long-lived investment, which I think sounds like you were there for 10 years.
We were, yeah.
One thing you're most proud of that was a Berkshire contribution, whether on the buy, the own, the refinance, the sell, what was the thing that you would pick on that in a way most captured what you contributed?
That's a very good question. I think what we're most proud of is we never tried to change SRS's culture. They had a culture that, again, mirrored many of our attributes in terms of it's about team. It's about commitment to growth. It's about growing the organization and putting great people in place. And it's always helpful when a company is outperforming every quarter and every year. Keep doing what you're doing. But we did recognize that along the way, we did have to make a transition. Ron Ross, who was the CEO at the time that we made the investment, eventually transitioned to chair, and Dan Tinker, who had been Ron's sort of second in charge, was elevated into CEO and helping to navigate that succession, making sure that Dan was onboarded, Dan was put in a position of success, I would say is probably the greatest thing we were able to navigate during that period of time. Because Dan was able to come in and bring he retained a lot of the attributes which made SRS incredible, but was able to amplify them for the next chapter and the next chapter of growth. And we have an amazing relationship with Dan. In fact, me and one of my partners were just with Dan 2 weeks ago talking about what's next for him. They're off to an amazing start at Home Depot. It's interesting, Ian. It does go a little bit back to where we started about public-private ownership. Dan would say the ownership chapter with us was utterly amazing. And he would also say that the ownership chapter at Home Depot is off to an incredible start, because they do have, at their scale and size, at over $1 billion of EBITDA, they now have access to capital to do things more aggressively than they probably would have been able to do under private equity ownership. So it shows it can work in both worlds.
Mike, that's been awesome. Thank you very much indeed. Time is up. You've been very generous, very open, and very illuminating and very revealing. So thank you very much.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me. It's we're thrilled to be partners with you and the team, and I really appreciate the time today.
Wonderful. Thanks, everyone. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye bye.
A link to Capgen's privacy notice and full terms can be found in this podcast summary description and on our website.